Come to order. I want to thank all of you who have had to sit around here and wait. While we are on the floor, you know, that's so unpredictable. We just never know for sure what we're doing. Which sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But that's kind of the nature of the business, and we are accustomed to that, but I know it's hard when you're sitting here waiting for a committee to start, and I appreciate your pleasant attitude about that. Also, committee members, thank you for your flexibility. We are going to start off today with Representative Klinzing's bill. And this is one, you know, that we already heard. We spent a lot of time on this in policy. So I would expect we wouldn't need to spend a lot of time on it in this committee also. So, Representative Klinzing, would you like to move your bill and explain it, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, I'd like to move House File 1544 to be before the committee and considered for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill. This is the bill that we worked out quite a few issues over the last couple years that I've carried it, so it is now, I think, into the form that is most, I think, most specific. What it does is it allows public charter school students to participate in extracurricular activities in their resident school district, and for resident public school students to also participate in public charter school extracurricular activities in their resident district. It does require that there be 30-day notice given to the team. It does require that the student has to go through all the same tryouts, also has to abide by all the same rules should they make the team, that the student has to abide by all the same conduct rules, attendance expectations, and grade expectations that are at the host school. There also is a provision to make sure that any student participating has to cover the indirect and direct costs of having that would be figured out by the district for having the student on the respective team. And we have Tess here today, who's acting director for Minnesota, or kind of the director in waiting, I guess, for the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, to speak on behalf of the director who was here but had to leave, Jay Martini.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Tess Tiernan. I'm interim executive director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be heard today. It is the hope of students, families, and member schools of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools that students are offered the opportunities to participate in extracurricular activities available in their districts of residence. This bill provides detail to that opportunity. It is understood that charter school students must give at least 30 days notice of their intent to participate in the district school's activity and obtain their charter school's written agreement to pay the cost of that student's participation. The charter school student would not be eligible to participate in the district school activity if that same activity is offered by the student's charter school or the activity is not controlled by the Minnesota State High School League. Charter school students participating in district activities will have to meet the academic and student conduct requirements of the resident district and the Minnesota State High School League. The charter school must also immediately notify the district if there is any change in the student's status affecting the student's eligibility. School districts could charge charter schools their students' proportional share of the direct and indirect costs of this extracurricular activity. These fees would be charged only if the charter school students were actually selected to participate in the district's school activity. A school district may also charge charter school students the same activity fee it charges the district students to participate in any extracurricular activity. And last, districts will not be required to provide transportation from the charter school to the resident district for participating in those activities. The opportunity to participate, be challenged, and learn in non-academic areas of extracurriculars is an essential component of education in Minnesota. The skills obtained and lessons learned create a well-rounded educational experience for the Minnesota public school students. Thank you again for your time and your attention to this matter.
That is the end of our testimony, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions for either the witness or the author of the bill?
No.
No?
Madam Chair?
Representative Heidberg.
I don't know what the rules are within this committee as far as offering oral amendments.
It has to be a very small amendment if it's an oral amendment.
It's a one-sentence amendment. And is the State High School League here? Perhaps you can address that before I offer the amendment, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
They are on the list of people who were going to testify. And
okay, I can wait until then if you want me to. Okay.
So if you wish to take the opposing right away before we ask other questions, we may do that. Representative Demmer, you have a question first.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have, and I don't know who would like to answer, is in the case of the charter schools we're talking about in their home districts, how many of the charter schools, and this can be approximate, are actually chartered by the home schools, by the resident school, the resident district? How many of the charter schools we may be talking about are probably chartered by the resident school district? Do we have information on that?
I don't have it right off the top of my head, and I'd hate to make a wrong statement, but I would hate to say 50% or anything like that, because I really don't know that number.
Okay.
All right, do you have further
comment
or question? All right, seeing no other questions, we will go ahead and take the other witnesses. Mr. Aronson, please, and Mr. Hess, do you wish to come up?
Chair,
Mr. Aronson.
My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the elementary secondary principals in the high school league. I actually was going to avoid testifying today. I've gone over this with Representative Klenzing quite a bit. We still oppose the bill, but I certainly would answer Representative Heigerkin's questions, and I know that the superintendent from Bemidji is here, and we have the athletic director from Minneapolis coming as well today. So.
All right, Mr. Heigerkin. Representative, do you want to ask a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a couple questions. A follow-up on Representative Demmer's thought. In regards to, I don't know if you can answer that, the number of schools that are chartered by a home district, what I need to understand is, are they included in the enrollment? Now, when you do your classifications within classes, I've had a number of school districts within my district had some concerns when enrollment was taken. For example, I have, I'll bring BBE up, for example. An enrollment count was taken there when the Hispanics were working the fields there. And they were included in the enrollment count at the time. And because of that, they're not around for any of the sports or anything. They're gone the majority of the year, and they come back again in spring. We, when I was in the city council over there, we built a complex for them to live and stay while they work the fields. So the kids do enroll in the school districts in the fall and in spring, but for a very, very, very short time. But somehow they got caught in enrollment. What I'm worrying about here is now, are these charter school districts, if they're making an agreement with a resident district, are they counting in the enrollment? Because right now, some of the way I'm looking at it is within the State High School League, we're getting some of the numbers skewed some of the schools are getting pushed up because charter schools are coming in with small enrollments. So can you address that problem? That it's creating a problem for the state high school. I realize that. But I have some concerns of how it's really going to drastically affect you.
Actually, Representative Heidgerken, I don't think we need to discuss the issue of, you know, your students who are here in October, go away for all winter and come back. Those are, you know, students that were in your school and come back to your school. You know, so let's keep the comments for the charter school issue because we have limited...
If I could, being that they're somewhat interrelated, I'd like to get a response on either.
Fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I know you have a full agenda and it's a long day. I'll be very brief.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that.
The what Representative Heidgerken is referring to is that when you do a cooperative sponsorship, the High School League recently changed its rules to say that we'll count all of the children from both schools for purposes of deciding what class they're in. That's resulted in some schools being moved from single A to double A, and not only with the charters are a minor part of that, but cooperative sponsorships have affected that as well. And I would say that Representative Heidgerken may be the sixth member that has raised this with me in one capacity. It's another, certainly the first one today. Yesterday was Representative Emmer. It had to do with Watertown, and this is an ongoing issue, and the High School League is working on it.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Do you have another question?
So my understanding, Representative Quincy, now that if this happens, if these agreements are made, that these charter schools within the resident district then would be counted in the enrollment for State High School League purposes in count.
Representative Quincy, I believe we have somebody coming up from the... you are representing the high school league. So,
well, Madam Chair, and I'm going to say this so that Aaron Ironson can correct me if I'm wrong so that I know that I've got this right, but it sounds like this is only in the districts that have cooperative agreements, and in the bill I'm carrying, this is really pertaining to those districts that don't have those yet, but that's not to say that your issue might then become an issue for the districts that would be affected by this bill. But it doesn't necessarily address the issue of those districts that already have struck cooperative agreements.
Mr. Aronson, can you?
Madam Chair, I think Representative Plensing is correct. There will be a new problem on this, as that the way that the law currently works, we have a cooperative agreement with a charter school, and we would count the charter school kids, and we would count the other district that's cooperating with them. This bill would say we no longer have the cooperative agreements if you opt under this model. So the league would have to decide what to do with that circumstance. And it's complicated by the fact that not all of the charter school kids would go to the same school. They go back to their districts of residence. So you may have, it'll pose a bit of a problem for the high school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Aronson, are the rules that govern the classes and enrollment figures, are those in statute or are those rules of the High School League?
Mr. Aronson.
Madam Chair, Representative Diskins, those are league rules.
Madam Chair.
Representative Diskins.
Madam Chair, Mr. Aronson, if a school has a homeschool student participating on their program, which I believe was a bill that passed former Speaker Carruthers got that legislation passed. If one homeschool student were to join a resident district program, does the High School League then mandate that all homeschool students within the resident district now be counted when it comes for its classification?
Madam Chair, Representative Biscuits, no.
Right. So, Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
So, Madam Chair, then it is definitely within the purview of the High School League to make rules regarding classification that seem to make sense. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Yes.
All right. Thank you. Jim Hess from Bemidji School District. And then that'll be followed by Mr. Thompson from Minneapolis. Representative Quincy, while he's getting seated, Is there ever a time when a charter school has a program that maybe someone from the public school would like to be part of, and is that generally not a problem?
Madam Chair, we do have examples, and I think they were provided in the last hearing, of charter schools that have programs that public school students of that resident district have participated in, and I know there's even some interest in my area with a math team at our charter school.
All right, Representative Bernardi, could you wait?
Yes.
Is that to that issue, or can we wait for the witness?
We can wait. It was regarding what you just asked, because I have an interest in that, too.
Oh, all right. Go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, we have to have special legislation for kids to participate in the charter school stuff, because we now have one just starting in our community of bioscience, and they're advertising mentorships and other things like that seem appealing. Would our children be able to participate in that, or do we have to have special legislation for that?
Representative Klensing, to tell you the truth, I don't know, but I would guess that that's maybe a question for Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, the way that charter school law is structured, it says that charter schools are not subject to laws that districts would ordinarily be subject to unless it's specifically specified otherwise.
All right, that's not really something. So I guess the answer is we aren't sure. But it looks like it would be kind of a mutually agreeable thing. However, I would guess if there are students from the charter school participating at the regular school district, that some of their students would be welcome to participate at the charter school as well. So I would be surprised if this was only a one-way deal. And would you go ahead, please, Mr. Hess? I'm sorry I interrupted you with that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jim Hess, Superintendent of Schools in Bemidji. I'm pleased to be with you this afternoon. I'd like to, because of the time that you've spent across the way, be succinct in my discussions, but there are three reasons why I believe that this is not a good measure and why I hope that you will not be supportive of it. First of all, this measure represents an intrusion on local control. Just as you may believe the 1,300-plus pages of No Child Left Behind or statewide speed limits on residential streets could be construed as an intrusion on local control, this, I believe, is as well. These kinds of decisions are best made by people in the local district who are aware of the situation, and I would strongly advocate that this would be taking away the decision from locally elected representatives. Secondly, you should honor people's choices. Charter schools choose to spend how their resources will be divvied up. One of our charter schools provides laptop computers for all their students. One allows for extensive travel during a J term, where students travel the globe with school financial support. They choose to offer these opportunities, just as we in Bemidji area schools choose to offer a wide range of extracurricular activities, including over 29 varsity level sports. Parents and students make a choice, J term and computers or extracurricular. Why should we have to pay for their choices? Next, you choose to run for the House of Representatives. State senators and the governor seem to have a little larger offices, maybe a little bit more posh chairs. You know, it's your choice. And if you want to have the thing that the governor has or that the state senators have, then you need to choose to make that run. It's all about competition. We started public schools to create a broad basis of understanding for all the children. Charter schools were started to provide competition for K-12. And so it seems like you're wanting to take away a competitive edge that a school district might have. It'd be like asking Bill Gates to give away his Microsoft proprietary information to one of his competitors. The current language of 1544 would keep a team of attorneys and accountants busy for months. It will be very difficult to agree on what constitutes direct and indirect costs from an athletic program. Do we include the HR office time for providing background checks, coaching applications, posting vacancies, reviewing previous coaching performances, etc.? Do we include maintenance costs for fields and court preparation, fertilizer, weed control, gasoline for mowers, floor wax, trash removal? Do we include superintendent time to listen to the parents and community members unhappy with a coaching decision or a losing season, playing time, or cheerleading apparel? A reasonable case might be made for each of these things as a charge to a program expense. Great opportunity for differences of opinion in this application seem to be present. This is not about equal opportunities. Okay, don't be misled. There are no rules that say state charter schools are forbidden to create their own teams, hire their own coaches, develop their own schedules, join their own leagues. That's not the case. This is about choice, whether or not you choose to create a special class of schools who make choices and then would like the state to require other districts to provide every other available choice to them as well. Thank you.
Mr. Hess, charter schools are public schools. We always seem to forget that when we get into these discussions. Mm-hmm. I want that to be very clear.
Absolutely.
They are public schools. Also, I think under our law, they don't have the right to do any bonding to build buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So they aren't in this quite the same ballpark as a regular school district that has that authority.
Madam Chair, they do receive special funding for facilities, to lease facilities, startup costs.
Exactly
they,
that. They
receive
they
$1,500 per student for a facility.
Yes, Mr. Hess, what I was saying is they aren't allowed to bond to build themselves a gym or an ice arena or a performing arts center or things like that. So there is a difference, and I think we can't make that playing field look like it's totally level.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Thompson. And Mr. Biskin, Representative Biskin has a question for you. Mr. Thompson, are you around? What?
Washington.
Who is John Thompson? Oh, all right. All right. All right, I'm sorry. There is no Mr. Thompson, but there is a Mr. Washington. No, go ahead, please say we have a question for you, Representative Bishop.
Well, Madam Chair, it isn't a question for the testifier, but it is a comment to the committee. It is a little ironic, it seems, when Representative Greiling and I introduced a bill earlier this session, it seemed like the school districts had a very firm grasp of the cost of extracurricular activities. And in fact, the mantra over and over again was that it was such a small savings to the budget that our bill would virtually do nothing for them. And now we hear, of course, that number one, it is incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to calculate the costs of extracurricular, and that it's astronomical, apparently, as the testifier was listing. So it appears somebody's trying to have things both ways, and that's unfortunate, because the bottom line is, we can have the discussion about, the charter school system or the traditional brick and mortar system, both of which are public school systems, both of which educate public school students. The bottom line is, we should be having a conversation about the kids, and we should be looking at maximizing opportunities, both educationally, extracurricularly, et cetera, for all kids, and not trying to protect some kind of turf. And that's a little frustrating when it sounds like we're deviating into protecting turf rather than helping kids.
Mr. Hess, please hold on. Representative Dorn has a question also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think this is an area of the bill that I, still haven't, fully, figured out what might happen or could happen. But it seems to me, the way I read the bill, that it would be the district public school. And this is a financial arrangement between two of our schools, and we would expect, I think some detail and fairness and due diligence. It reads to me that it is the district school that would determine whatever the indirect and direct costs are, and then that would have to be paid at the moment or the day that the student was selected to appear. So I could imagine there could be some disagreements over how you calculated that, but it appears that however it is calculated, that is what it will be. And I would certainly hope that the district public school would come up with a formula that has to be justifiable and defensible, we know, and I'm sure that's what they would be after. The question I've got, and I hadn't thought of this, is it possible, Dr. Hess, that would the indirect costs be different, do you think, or could be different according to the activity that the student was seeking, so that someone going out for the track team might trigger a different indirect calculation than someone for the basketball team, and that would be also a part of what would have to be transacted?
Mr. Hess.
Absolutely. The cost will vary by sport or by extracurricular activity. They could also vary by location. In some cases, school districts are renting ice time. In some districts, school district owns the facility, so they wouldn't be paying a lease amount. And of course, as you know, some sports are much more costly than others. Hockey, for one, is a very costly experience if you've ever put your kids in pads on the ice. And then also, golf doesn't cost nearly so much, or track doesn't cost nearly so much. So we're looking at some wide variances here.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Are there any other questions for Mr. Hess? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Mr. Hess. Our school district just found out a charter school is moving in. We don't even know where it's going or anything other than they've advertised through a flyer. And what I want to know is, I want to follow up on what I had asked earlier and what you had asked. Do you see your students in Bemidji that are in your school who might want to be offered some of the things that are in the charter school? You keep them as students, but they can be a part of a mentorship program or part of a trip to Italy, because that's what they do in some of the schools in my area, charter schools. They do those kinds of things. I mean, I'd like to see this bill have reciprocity the other way. Do you see that as at least making it a little more fair? Mr. Hess.
It presently doesn't exist. We have three charter schools in our district and a fourth one that's in the planning process. And so it would be, I think, more equitable if the things that they had available that made their school special or was a special inducement for enrollment, if those could be enjoyed by all of the students. But frankly, I could send them, a number of our sophomores for their J term, and the school would never be able to afford the number of trips and the number of laptop computers that they provide to their other children that are currently enrolled in the charter school.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clinton.
To that point, I am supportive of reciprocity when it comes to what this bill is about, which is about the Minnesota State High School League activities. What you guys are discussing are not Minnesota State High School League activities, and we are focused on those because in a discussion I had last year with some school districts who were trying to work out not necessarily support for the bill, but should the bill pass, what the most palatable bill would be, is they wanted it restricted to Minnesota State High School League activities. And so that's where I would like to keep this conversation, because that's where the districts wanted to keep that conversation. And to say we're going to be exchanging a place on the basketball team for a trip to Italy really isn't an apples-to-apples comparison.
Perhaps, Representative Bernardi, that has to be a separate issue or a separate bill,
mm-hmm.
That would look at that particular mm-hmm. issue. Because this has been pretty much the State High School League activities, so we probably should keep it to that. Are there another question? Representative Hager.
Thank you, and just a follow-up of Representative Biskins' comments and comments over here. I, too, feel the same way. I know you're coming from with the charter schools of them trying to participate in extracurriculars that they perhaps can afford. But, we have that out there in rural Minnesota. I would like to see my BBE kids be able to go to, we offer just the probably 6-7 sports, that's it. It'd be nice if we could go to Wilmer and get involved in their 42 programs they have. Can we do that? No, we can't do that right now. So I'm just saying, if you can do it for one, perhaps we ought to look at expanding it and make it available to all the programs available to all the kids.
Yeah,
I'll hold it. That's
Madam Chair.
Representative Flinsey.
To that point.
It's getting to be fun.
Always is. This bill never goes too quickly. You know that. The I got a couple emails from parents this week in as they were writing in support of the bill, and they reminded the whole committee, because it was carbon copying the whole committee, that these are residents of the district paying taxes of the district to the schools that are offering these activities. These are not residents of another district going wherever they want. And there are differences between what charter schools receive in revenue and what the non-charter public schools receive in revenue, and especially when we were talking about the lease aid. That's lease aid. It's, you can't own a building, and that makes it very tough on charter schools sometimes that they can't ever own a building and build, just like the regular schools can bond for those things and bond for huge gymnasiums and ice arenas, etc. So, and these are parents who are paying for those things. These are parents living in the district. And one of them said, I voted for the referendum. I'm very supportive of increasing, you know, taxes to send to my local schools, my local public schools. And so I do think that, and these are also parents oftentimes that whose kid, they're very aware of the cost of these activities because their kid's been involved in these activities through the community education program up until the point in some districts at the point of 10th grade where suddenly all these activities are shifted to the high school and away from the community ed departments. These kids have been playing together for 10 years and suddenly they're told for the last 3 years, nope, you can't play together.
You know, I think we should let Mr. Washington get in his testimony because we only have a few more minutes on this bill, folks. Remember, this bill has been heard over and over, actually. I think all last year this bill was heard, and I think it's been heard quite a bit this year already. So this is, you know, going to be laid over. Mr. Washington, would you give us your testimony, please? And I'm sorry I had the wrong name.
That's okay. My name is John Washington. I'm the District Athletic Director for the City of Minneapolis. And we currently do have a cooperative agreement with a number of charter schools to compete in Minneapolis. We do charge the students or the charter school a fee for participating in various sports. And we have a scale that runs depending on what the sport is, whether it be football, basketball, whatever the activity is. And it runs all the way for both men and women, and that we charge this charter for students to participate. Currently, during this school year, we have co-ops with three various charter schools, and they participated in football, cross country, and those were the major two sports that they competed in. It seems to be working well for us. To have a student just show up, though, unannounced and say that they want to participate may present some problems for us. The bill that we currently have seems to be doing the job that it was intended to, and that is the students that live in our the school's attendance area are able to participate on their high school team. And that's the main issue. Is I heard someone say that the main issue is having students participate, and I think the policy that we've adopted by our school board meets that criteria of having students able to participate at their high school level.
Thank you very much, Mr. Washington. In fact, it seems to me if anybody is wondering how to do this, you might be a good resource for them. So thank you very much for telling us that you've already got it all set.
Yeah.
Representative Biskins and Representative Bernardi, two more questions quickly.
Madam Chair, I'll narrow it to one.
Oh, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up with Representative Klimzing said. She talked about how these kids have been playing with community ed for so long, and then all of a sudden they can't play anymore because it's now at the high school level. You know, that happens to kids that are in the regular public school, too. My daughter played basketball, and she was no longer as good as the other kids, and she was weeded out on that team. And, you know, frankly, as a parent, I would be really upset if another student from another charter school got put on that team, and my daughter couldn't play because of that. I mean, those are her classmates. That's her team spirit. And it happens to kids in the regular public school, too. So I just wanted to point that out. It's happened to my own child.
Madam Chair.
Representative Plunging.
Yeah, and the charter school students, the residents public charter school students would have to do the tryouts just the same way. So there's not going to be any bumping going on. And I know that that was the testimony in the last committee, and this is strictly written that the same tryout process would apply to the public charter school students. But I know that doesn't necessarily take care of your concern. I do wish that the high schools offered extracurricular activities to a wider base of the population and not just to those who make the teams.
Mm-hmm. That's where club sports or community sports come in, I guess. We are going to, Representative Dabney, did you have a question also?
Madam Chair, I'm supposed to have an amendment on this bill, and I'm just checking on its status.
Well, I have an amendment here. We just received it.
Yes.
I don't know where it was. Did you just come up with this amendment?
No. If you look at the top of the 1544A1 amendment, it was prepared on the 4th.
And what happened?
Great question. I can't explain it, but it did not get forwarded properly.
All right. I can't explain it either. We will quick pass these out. We will take up your amendment, but please, people, be sure one way or another your amendment is getting to the committee staff. So we just got this right before committee started and had some copies run in case you really did want to do it. I just wasn't sure. Actually, it doesn't have a name on it, so. Would you like to explain your...
Certainly.
Would you like to move and explain your amendment, please?
Certainly. Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the H-1544A1 amendment to be before the committee. This amendment just simply reestablishes the local control idea, allowing school districts and charter schools to make the choices on the local level. It even allows folks to go down to the sport by sport, or maybe I should speak more specifically, activity by activity level. One act play, yes. I don't know, synchronized swimming, no. It's modeled conceptually, actually, after language in Representative Klingzing's site-based management bill that allows for local control in that. You may also recognize from Representative Emmer's bill regarding driver's licenses and high school dropouts that has a local opt-out, as well as the general status already of cooperative sponsorships and joint powers agreements that all allow school districts to opt out. And so this simply puts the charter schools and the school boards together in the same room to talk through what are the issues, what are the costs, where can they work together, so on.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I've allowed Representative Dabney to explain the amendment, and I thank you for that. However, Madam Chair, unlike the Committee on Education Policy, where we did not establish a rule for amendments, I thought this committee did indeed have a 24-hour rule. And I've taken that to heart, Madam Chair, because I'm not prepared to speak to this amendment, and I'd like to be able to speak to this amendment because it's an amendment, and I can bring down the material which is now sitting up in my office because I thought we were beholden to a 24-hour rule. Madam Chair, you have the rule, and I appreciate it. I would say that if this amendment were not brought up today and this component were in the omnibus bill, the amendment could then be put forward prior to the markup of the omnibus bill within this committee. So I don't want to silence Representative Dabney or his idea, but I think, Madam Chair, the precedent, if you were to allow this amendment at this time, would be a highly dangerous one, because later on, when it comes to marking up the omnibus bill, I would think that any amendment offered at any time by any member would have to be ruled appropriate. So I'd ask, Madam Chair, that we not bring up this amendment, and I'll wait for your response.
Representative Biskins, Representative Dabney, normally I would not hear this amendment. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened to your amendment and how it was supposed to have gotten to our committee. It did not get here, but it is dated the 4th. Now, I know anybody can type something up and date it the 4th. I understand that, but I am giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I appreciate your fairness to this issue, and you've always been fair. And I have nothing but the highest regard for Representative Daphne's integrity. And so when he says that it was completed on the 4th, I can only believe him. However, the fact remains that I have material in which I could use to speak to this amendment, and I was not prepared to do it because it was not put before us at, ahead of time. I don't want to silence Representative Daphne and the amendment. I do believe there is a time and a place for it to come back. All right. So at this time, Madam Chair, I move to table the amendment.
All right. That is not debatable. All those in favor of tabling, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I believe the ayes have it. But you will have another opportunity. All right, Representative Klinzing, do we have any more questions for Representative Klinzing or Mr. Hess or Mr. Washington? Seeing none, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Klinzing. I think this is right on time for you, right? All right, we are going to move on to Representative Sharon's bill. House File 2078. And just, there are plenty of chairs sitting around here, folks. If there are more of you, just pull up more chairs. Mr. Representative Sharon, as soon as he's done getting signatures of the witnesses, he will come and distribute that.
Madam Chair, I can do that. You put page one day in my committee, so I'm going to return it.
Thank you, Representative. The Representative Sharon, I would move House File 2078 before the committee and that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I think, would you go ahead, Representative? You don't have an amendment, do you?
I do not.
Okay. So please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right now being passed out to you is the executive summary of the Governor's Task Force for Education Finance Reform. As part of that report, they talk about adjustments to the funding formula. And I quote from the executive summary on page 6, under number 1, second paragraph, "This formula should take into account the added costs included with relative characteristics of each student, and in addition, Minnesota's new funding formula should compensate districts for cost factors beyond their control, meaning student population sparsity, technology access, and higher cost of living." Madam Chair and members, House File 2078 recognizes the higher cost of doing business for school districts in the metro suburban areas and other areas like Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth, among others. Right now, we do have compensating factors in the funding formula. There are several factors that we already recognize that make the cost of running a school district more expensive. Just two examples are sparsity revenue that rural districts get $1,000 or more per student, and compensatory revenue, which is given to the poorer districts. Because of the higher cost of doing business, these school districts in the metro suburban areas and areas like Rochester, Duluth, and St. Cloud, among others, these districts must rely heavily on levies on their citizens, and this drives their property taxes up disproportionately. With me to testify for this bill today are Scott Cumquist from AMSD, Superintendent Dennis Peterson from the Minnetonka School District, and Superintendent Tony Johns from the Brooklyn Park School District. Brooklyn Center. Ooh, I know, that's a big rivalry. Brooklyn Center School District.
I thank you. I take it you're first, Mr. Kroonquist.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we really want to thank Representative Sharon for bringing this bill forward and all the co-authors on House File 2078. We believe this bill addresses a fundamental flaw in Minnesota's current education funding system. Virtually every study completed in the past few years in Minnesota and across the country has recommended that regional, market-driven cost differentials be accounted for in the funding formula. Representative Sharon already referred to the most recent study, the Governor's Finance Reform Task Force. In addition, the Minnesota Taxpayers Association recently completed a study, and then that was conducted by Dr. John Ruggiero. That study also recommended that cost differentials related to the cost of labor be included. We've seen a variety of studies across the country in recent years conducted by researchers from John Augenblick to Jim Guthrie, names that many of you are probably familiar with. Virtually every one of those studies has recommended that in the part of the funding formula include a component to recognize cost of living differentials. Nine states, Madam Chair, members, have provisions similar to this in their law. A further interesting note is if you, many of you I'm sure read Education Week and you will read their rankings that they have from time to time comparing states. When they put those rankings out, they adjust them. They adjust the state aid by, again, cost of living differentials so they can have a apples-to-apples comparison. So we think that the research and the evidence is really overwhelming that this is an area that should be addressed. I have a brief PowerPoint, Madam Chair, that I'll run through, and there should have been copies handed out as well to follow along.
I think that would be this, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see by the first slide, it's just a fact that wages are higher in the metropolitan area. This slide here shows that, and this is not looking at education-related jobs, this is looking at jobs across the private sector. And the average hourly wage in the metro area is 31.7% higher. If you do look at just education-related jobs, you can see that, in fact, actually, wages are already compressed in the education field, as there is that differential drops to 18.2% when looking at education-related jobs. However, when you consider that school district budgets are comprised of about 75 to 80% of their costs are related to personnel, and then you think about the fact that metro schools in that area, that makes up 75 to 80% of their budget, experiences an 18% higher cost pressure, you can understand the impact and the pressure that's felt. This slide, members, looks at the cost of housing around the state. And the reason we include this, and we actually try to stay away from looking at a cost of living issue. That's not what this is really about. This bill is trying to get at the cost of doing business differential, and the fact that metropolitan districts and other parts of the state have a higher cost because of the higher labor costs they face. But we get oftentimes we hear that if we do something to recognize this, then it's just going to cause teachers in rural areas to leave for the metro area. And we don't think that that bears out when you consider the fact that the cost of housing in the metro area, as you can see, is the median-priced house is over $170,000, whereas in some parts of the state it's actually under $70,000. And so this is a significant disincentive, we think, for a teacher to move just from the rural area to the metro area. They certainly wouldn't come out ahead based on just the higher housing costs. And this just looks at this issue in a little more detail. You can see that if you would take the average teacher salary by economic development region and figure out what percent of their salary they would have to spend on the average price house in that economic development region, here again you see the discrepancy. In the metropolitan area, the average teacher would pay more than 30% of their salary to afford the average price house. And again, in other parts of the state, that actually can be under 15% of their salary required to afford the average price house. The Minnesota Education Funding Formula recognizes a variety of cost differentials, as Representative Sharon pointed out. Here, if we look at, this is the way the Department of Education categorizes the data, and you can see at the bottom, GM stands for Greater Minnesota, so on the far left, you'd have the greater Minnesota districts with enrollment less than 500. And then as you move across, you can see you have the suburban districts in Minneapolis and St. Paul. AMSD board members believe that these categoricals are legitimate, are research-based, and that they recognize real cost differentials. For example, the Sparse City categorical, that recognizes a significant differential in cost of doing business for rural school districts. When you have geographically isolated areas, there's going to be higher costs. The funding formula should recognize that, and it does. Now, we could talk about whether or not it's adequately. Does the Sparse City formula need to be increased? But the fact is we do recognize it in the current funding formula. Likewise, we recognize the fact that concentrations of poverty bring higher costs. You would ask our suburban superintendents if they look covetously at the compensatory revenue in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they would say no, because they understand that the costs that are associated with that are real, and that would not be that if their districts had the same concentrations of poverty, that they would receive a similar proportion of compensatory. But they know that that's not a money-making proposition for them. Clearly, what's missing here is a recognition of the cost of labor, the differential that metropolitan school districts face due to the higher cost of labor. And what that has resulted in is metropolitan districts relying on the operating referendum. So here we add the green bar is the operating referendum. And in essence, the local property taxpayers in the metropolitan area are picking up that 18% higher wage differential that their school districts face. That, of course, puts tremendous pressure on the local property taxes because, as you all know, in the metro area, in the suburban districts and Minneapolis-St. Paul, when they do pass a referendum, it's the local property taxpayers that, by and large, are paying for that. You can see up 87% for suburban districts, when they pass a referendum, that's being paid for by the local property taxpayers, only 13% through state equalization aid. So in closing, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the two superintendents, but we do think that the House Bill 2078 recognizes a research-based, a legitimate cost of doing business differential. And we already recognize other costs of doing business differentials, and we really think this is just a matter of fairness and equity in addressing that the costs that school districts face. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Are you next, Mr. Peterson? Is that chair a little low? I think you can.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm passing around a PowerPoint that I brought as a backup in case my real PowerPoint did not work, and so I'm just going to use the paper copy and walk through that for you. I'm Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of Schools in Minnetonka, and we are a member of AMSD. We are a metro school district, and what I'd like to talk to today are the issues that our district faces, what we as a metro district face, and the value to our students in having greater equity due to a regional operating cost differential built into the formula. And I applaud the efforts of the legislature to consider House File 2078, and with that background, I'd like to walk through the material that I've presented to you. We have in the West Metro, and I think often in the entire metro region, some misconceptions that we need to deal with. One of those misconceptions is that a wealthy tax base translates into more school revenue. That is not true. There is no relationship between the tax base and the school revenue that a district receives. The state establishes all the basic formulas that determine that, and Mr. Kronquist just articulated that with the mix of local taxes and state aid that go into providing those resources. There's also a stereotype, I think, that West Metro districts are higher spending districts, that they provide more offerings and lower class size, and that is not true either. Minnetonka, for example, ranks 99th out of the 343 districts in spending in 2002-2003. And that's with the lack of a differential for cost of doing business. Mr. Kroonquist has already talked about the differential, but I'd like to touch on it just very quickly. It's really coming at the fact that wages in our part of the state, or really as the bill acknowledges, differentials throughout the state make it more expensive in various parts of the state to employ staff and purchase services. And because of the fact that personnel in an educational enterprise makes up such a large portion of our budget, we believe that a differential is necessary in the formula. The next page you have is a repeat of what Mr. Kroonquist showed you, in that it costs 18% more for educational personnel in the metro area. And lest anyone thinks that we just are more free with our limited dollars than outstate districts, we've provided the background material relative to the cost of other enterprises, private enterprises, if you will, throughout the metro area, where it's actually even higher differential at 31.7% differential in the private sector. So it's not just a matter of local boards giving higher wages to metro employees. It's a fact of life and the pressures that we deal with. So you've already been apprised of the fact that the Governor's Task Force and others have advised us to consider market-driven personnel cost differential. I'd like to talk a little bit about a differential that had really evolved through the policies that were in place up to 94-95, and how that has been mitigated since that time through new policies established by the legislature. We've established, for the sake of discussion, two comparison groups. One is what we're calling the West Metro Group, which includes Eden Prairie, Medina, Hopkins, Minnetonka, Orono, and Wayzata. And for comparison purposes, some comparable non-metro districts that are outstate certainly would not be necessarily considered rural communities, but are smaller cities, if you will, in outstate Minnesota, Duluth, Gibbing, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. Comparing those 12 districts, we found that in 94-95, there was approximately a 20% differential in funding available to the two groups. West Metro had 20% more resources in 94-95 than the what we're calling the non-metro six. We believe that implicitly recognize the cost of doing business differential. There's more leeway with without caps on referendums and so forth to address the pressures that existed in the various parts of the state up to that point. The next page then shows the transpiring of changes over the subsequent 10-year period, during which time West Metro districts grew by about $1,250 per student. The non-metro six grew by about $1,862 for a difference of $612 difference in growth during the 10-year period cited. That brought the difference between the two groups from 20%, which was recognizing the cost of doing business differential, down to about 4% difference as it exists this year. On the next page, we then put some percentages to that, same data, and showing that the West Metro districts have gone up about 25% in that 10-year period, the non-metro districts by 44.9%. Had we gone up at the same rate as the out-state districts, we would have had an additional $991 per pupil. Then looking at comparison of rankings of districts on a per pupil expenditure basis, a little bit different period of time, 92-93 to 2002-2003, because those are data that were available for this table. You can see Minnetonka, for example, my district, dropped in rankings from 45th to 99th during that time. The non-metro 6 increased their ranking collectively by 37 places, and the two urban districts, Minneapolis and St. Paul, increased their ranking from 25th to 14th during that period of time. The impact of this is on programs, on students, on staffing available, and on the next table you can see that for 2002-2003, when the difference had dropped and we felt the even greater impact of tight resources in the state during that time, districts in the Midwest Metro are now staffed at a considerably higher level, more students per staff member than what the non-metro area is, and even the state average. If we were staffed at the same as the state average, collectively, the six districts could have another 174 teachers to work with our students. If we were staffed at the same level as the non-metro schools, we could have another 222 teachers for our students. So you can see that there's been a real impact on real school districts and real students during this 10-year period. If we had in Minnetonka received $612 more per pupil, it would have meant about $5.5 million more in revenue. We've just completed a process of cutting about $3.5 million from our budget for next year. If funding had increased at 44.9% rather than 25%, we would have had $8.4 million in additional revenue with which we could use for addressing student needs. Much of this difference in funding over time has been through a various categorical funding approaches that the state has chosen to put in place. One of those is what we call categorical. You can see that of the six West Metro districts, the highest ranking among us is Hopkins at 321st place out of 343 districts. Minnetonka actually ranks next to last and Edina last in getting state resources for categorical funding. And at the bottom of that page, you can see the 95th percentile place and the 5th percentile place, and only Hopkins is above the 5th percentile. That's pretty low when you start looking at any tables. Going to the next page, which is titled Status of Minnetonka Operating Budget, we, as I've indicated, we've played this all out now in terms of the impact on students, and I want to provide you with that kind of background. We've not had an increase in state funding since 2002-2003. We've had to deal with inflationary pressures of utilities, fuel, wages, all of that, that's gone up about 3-4%, and an overall increase in the general fund budget about $2.2 million during that time. On the next slide, you can see the state average from 97 to 2003 was an increase in spending of about 32.7%. Minnetonka went up 16.9% during that time. So we've really managed very scarce dollars during that time in order to meet the needs of our students and help them become competitive in the world economy. We've implemented budget reductions in 8 out of the last 10 years, and we've had one referendum that was successful in 2002 that helped mitigate some of those reductions. The next page shows a history of budget adjustments in our district. You can see starting in 96-97 through the next year, the dollars that have been reduced in our budget over those periods of time. So those are having this change in policy is having a real impact on the Minnetonka School District, and I would suggest there are others in similar situations. Just for next year's budget, we are eliminating 30 teaching administrative positions in our district. We're going from a 7-period day to a 6-period day at both the middle school and high school. That's reducing course opportunities for students in those levels. We're increasing fees for transportation and student activities and parking and so forth. We're reducing costs in custodial, health services, etc. To conclude, I want to make the point that all metro school districts are impacted by higher personnel costs. But I also want to make the point that the differences extend beyond the metro area. There are differences throughout our state, and this policy proposal should recognize the differences that exist, whether they be student characteristics or variables, as I'm just describing, that are beyond the control of the local board. Up to 1994, we were able, through higher referendums in the metro area, to deal with those cost differentials. Since the capping of referendums, that's been impossible to do any further. Finally, we believe that House File 2078 implements the recommendations of the governor's task force and makes a lot of sense in terms of school finance, in terms of providing equity among students throughout our state. Thank you.
I think before we take any questions, we'll go to Superintendent Johns. And go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Antoinette Johns, Superintendent of Brooklyn Center School District. And I'm speaking to you today because I have served both as a superintendent in a rural school district. It was McGregor, often recognized more if I say Big Sandy Lake and fishing. And it was a school district of about 1,000 square miles that had about 650 students when I was there and had about 12% Native American population. Brooklyn Center is the opposite. It's 2.8 square miles. And it does have a population of 68% minority. It has 59% of our students receiving either monitoring or direct services for English language learning, of which the majority coming in the last year and a half have been refugees as opposed to immigrants that have been schooled and have some English language or background for academics. Our student population is also 66% free and reduced. McGregor's population was also high free and reduced population. So while there were similarities, there are significant differences. And McGregor School District did receive a significant amount of money, was ranked about fourth in what it received for sparsity aid and transportation aid. Both districts had a significant issue in needing staff that was really dedicated to working with kids of color and students with the, in the case of Brooklyn Center, English language needs. As a superintendent of these two districts, I think I can speak about the cost differential both in living there and in employing personnel. And we still do maintain a home there, non-homesteaded in McGregor. When I returned to the metro area, I was very surprised by the fact that my secretary earned almost two times what my previous secretary, McGregor, had earned. And when reviewing our comparable worth studies at Brooklyn Center, it was the maintenance department that drove the comparable worth study, whereas in McGregor, it was the bus drivers, because it's very difficult to get bus drivers, wages were high, and they received full family health insurance. So different groups drive it, but when you looked at the maintenance department in McGregor, the man who was retiring after 28 years or 25 years of working there as the head of services received a salary of $28,000. The bus drivers earned almost half of what he did for driving less than 4 hours a day. In Brooklyn Center, that same man would be earning at that time about $40,000 a year. Brooklyn Center is not a high-cost salary district across the state or in the metro area. We have consistently used a set of seven districts to compare ourselves to, and they include Anoka, Robbinsdale, Osseo, and Minneapolis, because that's who we lose our employees to in the general groups. Teachers we lose to significantly higher-paying districts. We also compare ourselves to Columbia Heights, Fridley, and St. Anthony, and everything that we do as far as negotiations and our cost of services. And that's because they're similar in size and population to us. We have frozen salaries 1 year when we first were in SOD, and there was no language to make that up. at any point in time. And we've not given more than 1% and 2% salary increases. So we have definitely, as we've done business, we have brought ourselves from the bottom of the pay scale to about mid-range. And the reason we need to be mid-range is because we need to entice employees to come to our district to work with our students. In my district, the issue of who goes to school there does have a significant impact. And we had a swinging door as our senior staff retired from our high school and employees came in. We were unable to keep them. The Teachers at Risk program says that in urban and schools like mine, there should be a higher cost differential allowed for staffing in those districts in order to retain the staff. So in addition to the cost of housing and other costs related to maintaining a school district, we have a cost of trying to maintain employees that other national studies recognize should be also compensated. To employ and retain staff is significant when you're trying to raise student achievement to meet state and national standards. You can't do it with a novice walking in the room every year. You must have programs and staff development and consistent application of instructional strategies that will raise student achievement. Our governor is very committed to the teaching at risk outcomes and expectations, as well as having set up the committee that did the study that said there should be cost differentials. I'd be glad to respond to questions. Or as with
all
the
right,
the committee.
I think all of them will now respond to questions. Do we have questions? Representative Heidzer.
Thank you. I have a series of questions. First of all, a comment. Numbers are skewed. Superintendent, you brought up class sizes average state of Minnesota. You got to remember that when you look at numbers, 13% of the sites have less than 1% of the kids. So let's take that in perspective, first of all. If you take 1% of the kids and sign them off, let's forget about that. Let's talk about 99% of the kids. Now you can see class sizes come up pretty close, pretty comparable. Getting to some of the questions here, and I have a series of them. First of all, Mr. Peterson, you're superintendent at Minnetonka, right?
That's right.
Okay. How many football coaches do you have there?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
I think we have 12 coaches that the district pays for, and then there are volunteers who assist them.
Okay.
Representative Heidgren.
Thank you. Has it been true that the district, I know they have their own website and that they have been looking at the possibility of doing something with their football stadium, of possibly putting a cover on it, a dome? Is there any truth? Is there any movement in that?
Dr. Peterson.
Chairman, Representative. We actually have just completed the first year of having an inflated bubble, as we call it, paid for entirely by rentals of that facility. So no district funds are involved in that, and so it's a community project.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Heidger.
How many foreign languages do you offer at Minnetonka?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Peterson, pardon me.
Representative, I believe we offer 6 in addition to English.
Okay.
Representative Heidgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're getting into personnel here in just a bit. How many ice arenas do you have in Minnetonka?
You mean in the city, Representative Heidgren?
Within the school district.
Dr. Peterson.
Representative, the school district does not have any ice arenas. There are, to my knowledge, 2 arenas in our in our geographic region, one of which is on the school property, but it's not owned by the district.
Okay. Okay, to that point again, we can make thank you, Madam Chair. We can make comments and we can do some comparisons. I just had a school district that cut down to 1 foreign language. I got 13 school districts with I think the majority have probably 3 or 4 football coaches, and we go on and on and on. But you had mentioned that within the personnel, 75% of the money is spent on personnel. And if this is true, wouldn't we have the same problem out there in rural Minnesota? The numbers would probably be even higher.
I'm sorry, Dr. Peterson. I didn't get the question.
Okay, is it true that you're spending the number one reason that you'd like to see the proposal that you have in front of you is because of the high cost of personnel? Is that true or false?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Peterson.
Representative, essentially it is because of the high cost of personnel. And if we have an opportunity, I'd like to address the real issues you've raised on the staffing, because they're not, as you seem to be implying, they're totally related to a different driving factor. But we are talking about the cost of our employees to live in this part of the state and what it takes our district then to compensate them to work here.
Okay. To that point, Madam
Chair.
Yes. When I look at, I'm looking at Osakis in my district is at 6,700, governor's proposal. Minneapolis is at around 12,400, almost double. Last year, there was a movement of the statewide teacher's insurance. The Minneapolis School District did not want to get in with the rest of the state because of the high cost factor of the rural teachers. Their insurance costs more. So again, if almost one-third of the teacher's salary is tied up in statewide in insurance itself, this is something that's playing against your numbers, would you say? I mean, if Minneapolis didn't want to get in with the rural school teachers because of that, plus, if I remember right, the Minneapolis school teachers years ago didn't want to get in teachers' retirement with the rural school districts. And again, when you look at the personnel, just to create a scene, I taught school in Bruton. Over half the school teachers there did not live in Bruton. They decided to go to a regional center where the houses are higher. Now, why would that be?
Madam
Dr. Peterson.
Representative, as a person who's grown up in a rural area, been a superintendent in a rural area, much of that's the unavailability of housing for teachers who might want to live in that community where they're teaching. For example, I was superintendent in the Southland District in the southern part of the state 30 years ago. We had teachers who would probably drive from Rochester. We certainly had teachers who went to Austin to live, but that was because there wasn't housing available within that school district.
Okay, to that point, Madam Chair.
Representative Heidger.
I've never heard anybody tell me that. I know that they go to Alec, they go to St. Cloud, is probably, I have a lot of them in Sauk Center and Melrose, all me that live in St. Cloud, probably over 50%. Because they can buy a house there that's more expensive, but they're going to get their money back. I bought a house in Bruton for about $35,000 when I sold it. I sold it for $20,000 10 years later. I didn't get my money back. You're always going to get your money back in growth areas when you make an investment in housing. So you recapture that when you sell your house. So housing should not be considered as one of the components in regards to teacher salary. The other thing in play is that you're seeing so much mobility. Within my community, we have a lot of people that are building in our community that are driving to the cities to work. They get their higher wage and they come back. So I mean, there's a lot of, we can go on. And the other thing is with salaries is that when you teach out in rural Minnesota like I did, I taught for 23 years. My high 5 years of experience determine what I get in retirement. So if you teach in the metropolitan area, you're generally going to get probably on the average of 10 to 15 grand more a year doing the same job in Minnesota. But you get paid for it the rest of your life in your retirement. So you get penalized again for teaching out state. When I look at the numbers that the governor's proposal, we're at $12,400 for Minneapolis, and we're at $6,800 for Osakis, and we're trying to pay teachers somewhat equal so that some will stay out in rural Minnesota and will apply to teach out there. We have a major, major problem of getting employees out in rural Minnesota that want to teach out there when they can teach for considerably less in the metro. But just if you want to comment on those, that's fine, but I think we're going to have some test fires on the other side too, though.
Madam Chair, we'd like to comment on one assertion that we
Dr. Peterson.
Representative, your assertion that we should not consider housing, the rest of it you and I could have fun talking about for the rest of our lives probably, but the assertion on housing, many of our teachers live in apartments. They don't buy homes, and the same differential exists with regard to apartments, and they obviously don't acquire any ownership in those apartments. Furthermore, there are very few of our teachers on our salary schedule that can buy, you know, a $200,000 house, which would be a very low-end house in the metro area. So, you know, they don't even get into that ownership piece of it, if that is even a viable argument.
I believe that Representative Heidgerk, and I believe Superintendent Johns wished to comment.
Just a comment there, Madam Chair. There's where the superintendent and I agree that we are not paying our teachers enough, but thank you.
Superintendent Johns.
Yes, I could make a comment about the housing costs. It does matter to our teachers. The teachers in Brooklyn Center have been talking to me, and we have younger staff that is coming in and now having their families and marrying, etc. Marrying and having their families, actually, in that order, which I appreciate as superintendent. But they have been looking at buying homes, and the average home in Brooklyn Center right now is $159,000, one of the cheapest ones. Some of our families of poverty can buy a home there because two families buy that home, and sometimes other relatives live there too. But our teachers have been saying to me, the only place we can afford to buy a home is in Brooklyn Center. So it's great for our kids that they see them in the community, but they don't have the resources to go somewhere else. And I could add that in our district, our community members are paying 4% of their annual income for property taxes. It's one of the highest four in the state per amount of income. And in rural Minnesota, on the average, it's 2.something%. And in our case, we only have $580 some in levy. They did approve, just like in a rural community, to replace the Earl Brown Elementary School, which impacts them exactly like it would impact a rural community of a few homes. But it's a district that's not wealthy in any way. And our ratio right now for teachers is climbing because we've made $3.2 million in cuts in the last 5 years, and we'll make another million in the next two.
Madam Chair, just
Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Kronquist, BNSD. Just quickly, when we talk about this issue, it always seems to stray to side issues, and housing being one of them, and property taxes. That is really not what this bill is attempting to address. What it is addressing is the cost of doing business differential. It's the fact that school districts in some parts of the state, certainly in the metro, have to pay higher salaries to attract the same positions, whether it's teachers, bus drivers, secretaries, it doesn't matter. So the other issues are really peripheral to the bill. I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I think that we have got to move here. We only have until 5 o'clock when we have to be back on the floor. We have somebody who wants to speak in opposition, Bruce Mon Plaisir. How do I pronounce this name? Mon Plaisir. Well, I was getting close. And after that, MREA, and then Schools for Equity and Education. So would you please all be prepared to move up in and out quickly? Because we have two more bills today. And these have taken a long time. Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I was going to, Madam Chair, I was going to share some materials with the representative here.
Yes?
Unless you gave him the materials ahead of time that I distributed to the committee.
He is not, I'm sorry, but okay. The representative is not part of this committee, sir.
Okay.
And what did you... Okay. We have some extras, so we'll get those. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate that you're allowing me to address this issue with you. I kind of feel like the Lone Ranger here with coming into the metropolitan area, because I know most of you are from the metro area.
That is not true on this committee.
Oh, okay.
It's absolutely evenly divided.
Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair. Well, House File 2078 could also be called the Minnesota State Finance Simplification Bill, because if passed, just as compound interest increases your interest earnings, the compound funding increases of the foundation allowance for the school districts in the seven-county metropolitan area will require all the revenue of the state of Minnesota to fund it in just a few years. That means basically that you won't have a Minnesota State Highway Patrol, a Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or a number of other departments. I believe you have the data that shows this legislation is intended to freeze the foundation allowance for most of the rest of Minnesota while increasing the foundation allowance for the seven county metropolitan districts by 3.5% the first year, 7% the second year, 10.5% the third year, 14% the fourth and following years, and this is the minimum it'll cost the state, and that minimum will only be maintained if the extra funding does not increase the wage disparity between the rest of Minnesota and the seven-county metropolitan area. If you look at the document that we have here, it says the Education Price Index as proposed by the Minnesota Association. But on the second page of that document, there's a grid, okay, and that shows that in each of the economic development regions, 1 through 10, the foundation allowance will be maintained at 4601 as it was in 2004-2005 through 2009-2010, okay? However, in Economic Development Region 11, where the Economic Development Education Price Index is at 0.14, the first year, the base year, is 4601. The second year, because it's only one-fourth of that 14%, it's 4762. The third year, because it would then be half of the prior year, it would be times that 7%, it would be 55,095. The third year, it would be 56,31. The fourth year, 64,21. And the next year, 73,20. And, of course, it continues that from then on. It would be going up at the rate of 14% a year. The legislation designates the seven-county metro area as one of the regions. It designates St. Cloud as another region. That would not generate any money, additional money beyond the 4601 for St. Cloud. It would not designate any money beyond the 4601 for Duluth. It would designate 6%, and the fourth of that is, of course, 1.5% the first year, 3% the second year, and so forth. And my guess is that as the metropolitan area expands, of course, that Rochester would be dropping out of that. Okay? And the data comes directly from the Minnesota Department of Economic Security. If you look into that a little bit further, it's got economic development regions. It's got the average weekly wage for each of those areas. That document is right here. It's got all of that information. It goes right on through each of the economic development regions by the state of Minnesota. And, of course, it shows you that everything is below one except for economic development region 11. The next thing has the counties, and then it shows you each of those regions by the counties. There's three pages of counties. And then because the legislation also addresses the cities, a few of Duluth, St. Cloud, and Rochester, I did include the data for Duluth, all of those cities anyway. You can kind of see where each of those falls, and you can kind of see that Duluth would be at 0.87, which is below the 1, and St. Cloud is at 0.3. Okay. In January of this year, I did put together a paper called Minnesota School Finance, a reaction to investing in our future. Investing in our future is a paper produced by the Governor's Committee studying school finance in Minnesota. I did send a copy of this document to Mr. Brett Walsh, and I believe each of you have a copy of that document as well as the document Education Price Index 2005. On page 5 of that document, I did list some programs that I have that have proven effective for all children. And although my first undergraduate degrees were in mathematics and physics, I also obtained a degree in elementary education in 1992 because I thought it important to have an understanding of the entire educational program. Early child family education, preschool education, and kindergarten readiness are my passions for education because those are the foundation for all learning. And I mean that for every student in the state of Minnesota, not just rural Minnesota, metro Minnesota, or anything. And while I'm a product of a one-room country school, my student teaching was at Brown Junior High, a school of 2,500 students in inner city Washington, D.C. I was the only Caucasian in the whole school in 1971. Student or teacher. And I do have a bit of an understanding of the large schools, even if neither my wife nor my four horses are interested in living in the cities. On page 27 of this document that I put together, back in January, let's see, I have listed the General Education Revenue Disparity Report, and a couple pages earlier it's the actual report that comes from the Minnesota Department of Education. And next to that, I've also listed the General Education Fund Expenditure Disparity per ADM for the 2003-2004 school year. Towards the bottom of the page, the General Education Revenue Disparity Report shows a dollar gap of $1,366 between those schools at the 99th percentile versus those at the first percentile. The expenditure disparity, taking all general fund expenditures in each district and dividing it by the average daily membership of each school district, shows an expenditure disparity of $5,373 between the 99th percentile and the first percentile. The General Education Revenue Disparity Report does show that those districts at the 99th percentile receive 29.6% more revenue per pupil than those at those districts at the first percentile. The general fund expenditure disparity per ADM shows that those districts at the 99th percentile were able to spend 82.3% more per student than those at the first percentile.
I think we're beginning to get the picture, sir.
Okay.
I think what this bill was designed to do was make people aware of just what the differential is in depending on where you live in the cost of providing an education. And I think that's kind of what this does. So I think we all get the message. We just can't go through everything that
well,
you probably
I'm
like
just
to
about
go
done. If you,
you are.
Madam Chair. If you want to go on.
All right, if Madam we're Chair. Just about done, please finish.
To, Madam Chair, to that point, I just heard testimony for 25 minutes on the other side, and he's been only 5 minutes.
I know, but we've got two more bills. I never expected this much time in all these bills. Go ahead, please, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, about 6 years ago, one of my colleagues complained to me that 20% of his general fund went to retirement benefits in the form of severance pay and ongoing insurance benefits. I looked for data to verify or discredit the statement. The data did not exist, but a few years ago, the Uniform Finance Accounting and Reporting Standards UFARS started requiring that those expenditures be coded to Object 191 and 291, respectively. I felt this important because when the Minnesota Department of Education reports that 70.2% of the general fund expenditures are for education-related services, the general public assumes that it is for current employees and materials. On page 77 of the reaction paper, the total general fund, food service fund, and community service fund 2003-2004 expenditures are listed for each Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 school districts in Minnesota. This data would be considerably different if all districts followed the UFAR's quoting requirements. I'm wondering if some of the need for additional funding in the metro area has something to do with retirement benefits, whether it's coded there or not. I got to tell you, I don't have an objection to any student in the metropolitan area. All six of my grandchildren live in the seven-county metropolitan area. Okay, the students in rural Minnesota are not asking you to give them all the advantages of metropolitan students, but they are asking for a fair, uniform, and adequate opportunity to be educated in a manner that prepares them for the modern world in which we live. Thank you.
All right, now if there are questions. Sir,
yes.
If this was in the omnibus bill right now mm-hmm. it's a separate bill.
Yes.
If it were in the omnibus bill, then there would be that base increase of 2.5% or whatever we end up with in the omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Question, did you have one, Representative Heidgerben? Anybody else? All right, we have two more people, I believe, who wish to testify on this. Somebody from MREA, and then Brad Lundell from the C Schools. Are you both testifying for MREA?
We are, briefly, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Sam Walfuck with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. MREA is made up of teachers, superintendents, and school board members from 150 rural school districts. And we're here to convey our strong opposition to House File 2078. The primary reason MREA opposes this bill is because we believe it runs counter to the state's constitutional obligation to support a uniform system of schools. This bill creates a cost driver within the basic formula that will send limited state dollars to our wealthiest districts. Some argue that because sparsity and compensatory costs are recognized and funded by the state, that the state should create and fund a cost of living adjustment for our wealthiest districts. I want to remind the committee that categorical aids such as sparsity and compensatory are meant to bring the bottom up by guaranteeing a minimal school infrastructure for geographically sparse districts and additional programming for our students who are the most at risk for academic failure. The Education Price Index will take limited state dollars and send them to districts that have the ability to levy extra dollars to pay their teachers more if the cost of living requires it. Rural districts don't have that benefit anymore as a result of the 2001 property tax legislation. Rural districts are heavily dependent on state funding to operate their schools. Creating a formula cost driver for wealthy districts that can also access property wealth creates an inequitable education funding system. Madam Chair, I'm going to be real brief, but before I close, I want to comment on two things. The first is the issue of the cost of housing in the metro area that seems to be behind this legislation. I know Mr. Kroonquist doesn't want us to talk about it, but it's what's behind this. And as a new homeowner, I understand that it's expensive to own property in the Twin Cities. However, home equity is the greatest source of wealth for the vast majority of people in this country. Being able to write off mortgage interest and your property tax is a huge benefit, not to mention being able to sell up to $500,000 of your home tax-free. We don't have that same home equity advantage in rural Minnesota. And lastly, the issue of wage competition with the private sector is a tough one. However, I haven't heard that suburban schools are having trouble hiring highly qualified teachers. Rural districts are the ones who need variances and other forms of licensure flexibility to meet our students' educational needs. We compete with the private sector, too, and our wealthy suburban neighbors. Teachers are drawn to the metro area because of better job opportunities for their spouses and higher wages and bigger home investments that are available in the Twin Cities. Building this cost driver into the formula will put rural districts at a further competitive disadvantage to our suburban friends. I'll finish with that, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Mr. Walseth.
Thank you.
Ms. Hasbargen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Renee Hasbargen with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I have been struggling with how we could best respond to this bill, and I just decided that I wanted to thank the Chair and to thank this committee for how focused they've been through this whole year, and now as you reach the pressure time of putting your bill together, I hope you'll remain as focused as you've been, saying that we're going to put money on the formula first for students. And then secondly, we're going to pursue QComp, or the plan that you have to improve instruction. Mm-hmm. And I have to be honest with you that when the governor's bill first came out, I wasn't so sure about the balance in that bill between investing in the kids and investing in improving instruction. My first reaction was that there was too much money in that bill. for the teacher portion, for the QCOMP portion. And then in February, I went to a national conference on the State Conference of State Legislators, National Conference of State Legislators, because the whole thing was on education funding. And they were talking about where states should be making investments. And I came away with the three most strategic things that states should be doing in terms of funding education. And the first and most strategic thing is you should be investing in good teaching. That's the whole QCOMP proposal. The second thing you should be doing is you should be building capacity in the system by starting early. And the third thing you should be doing is investing in technology, data, and information systems. And so I came away saying that your priorities, Madam Chair, for this year are absolutely right on, and I want to thank you for them. And so let's not look at paying people more based on the kinds of houses they live in, but let's look at how are they improving student achievement in their classrooms, and then let's look at what kind of leadership are they bringing to their job. Are they mentors? Are they masters? Are they helping to train new teachers? And then let's not look at houses again, but let's look in the future to if there's a shortage in math and science, probably we're going to have to pay those people more. If they're taking a tough assignment in a tough school, tough community, tough kids, probably those people do need to be paid more. In rural Minnesota, if you have multiple licensures, you're more valuable. We need to pay you more. But we don't pay people based on the kind of home that they live in. So I urge you, stay focused. Invest in the formula for all students, and then pay people more if they're better teachers. Thank you.
Thank you for that that support of my bill on quality compensation. Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm afraid I've been lumped in with the opponents to this bill, and I want to say from the beginning that the Schools for Equity in Education is neutral on this bill, but due to comments that I made earlier in the session in regard to the referendum cap bill, I felt it was incumbent on me to comment today. We have both Metro and non-Metro members within C. We're a 60-member organization that has represents about 280,000 students, about one-third of the state's student population. And as Metro and non-Metro, it's been difficult for us to come through with a consistent position on this. But I think the one thing that I did want to say, and as I said earlier this session, we believe that there needs to be a referendum cap, and that's clearly part and parcel of what's being discussed today, at least from me and from my organization's perspective. There are two elements, I think, in the referendum. One of them is cost pressure. One of them is demand pressures that come from communities. I think that this bill needs to be discussed because it can reduce the cost pressure portion of the referendum. And I think in doing that, it will reduce reliance on the referendum levy. This would give a more, I don't want to say scientific because it conjures up, equations that are three pages long, but I think it gives us a less arbitrary way to deal with the cost pressures that metropolitan districts may experience. And while the referendum is arbitrary, a number of the metropolitan districts that I represent have relatively low referenda. They've either gotten to the point where they can't pass anymore or they've reached the referendum cap. I think, so this may be a way that we can reduce reliance on the referendum in the metro area and in effect do it statewide and do it in a way then that addresses that cost portion of the referendum levy. I think that the demand part of the referendum levy is probably going to have to remain in place. There are different demands in different parts of the state. But I do think that this is, something that does warrant further discussion. I think the second point I would like to make is that this bill is a great improvement upon earlier iterations of this bill. This bill, the old cost of living bills used to say the metropolitan area and then everybody else. This one talks about the ability to look at different regions, to have different cost indexes in different regions. I think that that's an improvement and something that we clearly would want to look at. I represent districts probably in the collar count, a lot of districts in the collar counties, districts probably on that line from St. Cloud to Rochester, and 50 miles each side of that is probably the 75% of C's membership. Certainly in those districts there is low property wealth, but there is also pressures to meet costs that are higher than they are in other parts of the state. So we are not going to give this an unqualified endorsement, but we do think that There have been improvements made to the bill that at least make it far more palatable for our membership. Last but not least, I think that we have to talk about the general ed formula. And I think one of the things that's been happening around here, and it's been happening under a variety of governors and a variety of legislators controlled by both bodies, really one of the key issues here is that the general education formula continues to fall behind. That puts more pressures on categoricals. And those of us on this side, when money is scarce, we're all trying all of each other to get one categorical advantage or another categorical advantage. The key, I think, in my estimation, is to raise the general education amount to a level that is more reflective of the average amount it takes to educate a student in this state. I think we're too close to the minimum now, and that the categorical stack up on a minimum cost basis as opposed to an average cost basis. Getting us up to an average cost basis, I think, would reduce the reliance on referendum, would still allow us in a stream of categoricals to look at the things that MREA is concerned about with operational costs, look at the things that AMSD is concerned about with labor cost pressures, and probably come to something that's going to be unite this state more closely as to how we look at education. In closing, then, I'd just like to say that we are neutral. We are willing to discuss this. I think that, this was in the governor's task force. We would hope, I know that Representative Sandy Peterson has a bill talking about finishing the governor's task force report. We would like to see that discussed. We would like to see the discussion of the governor's task force go forward. Look at this in that venue, and then come up with a more sensible set of categoricals. This, I think, qualifies as one that really deserves serious consideration. So, with that, I will conclude my remarks and stand for any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Lundell or for the author? I think, Mr. Lundell, the author might enjoy visiting with you a little bit more to see what ideas you might have.
Absolutely.
Representative Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I do want to correct what I think are two incorrect assumptions here. One would be that wealth and property equal better schools or better funding, because we know that that is not true. I think it's an easy assumption to jump to, but we're all, for the most part, operating under the same funding formula. I think the other misconception, the overall misconception here, is that this is a metro versus rural problem. For one, this bill does not just talk about just metro areas, but talks about several areas of our state. The other is, too, I think that the one thing that we all had in common as we sat here and testified today is that we all are trying to do the best we can for our students in this state. And I know that nobody wants to take... my first job was teaching out in Atwater, and now those students have grown up, and those kids are going to that school. And I'm not looking to take money away from my friends out in Atwater, and I don't think anybody here does. We do recognize that for a lot of the districts we talked about, the number isn't 4601. It's 4601 plus 1,000, or 4601 plus 5,000. Some other type of compensatory revenue. So we do recognize that there are costs that are beyond the control of school districts under all kinds of different circumstances in this state. And this bill simply recognizes that cost of living is one of those factors. Thank you.
Thank you. And this House file will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Eakin, did you have a question for the author?
No, just a comment, if I could.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sharon. And I just wanted to comment that I know you said that you don't want to leave, your friends in Atwater behind, but I think, if it's going to be the same size pie or a shrinking pie, obviously it's going to divert resources from other schools, put in a system which would provide more for the wealthier school districts in the state. And I just wanted to make that clear, and so I feel that that what would end up happening is we would end up leaving some regions behind, and maybe we need a leave no region behind bill, but to make sure that all regions are looked out for. And just one other comment, as far as, you know, the cost factors, I think we need to look at all the cost factors, not just things like housing, where you will find a disparity between the rural and the metro areas, but also, you know, looking at the cost of gas and the cost of groceries. And in many cases, they're more expensive in the rural areas. The cost of groceries, for instance, is one good example there, and I think that needs to be taken into consideration as well. And also the lack of economies of scale. So
we do have
you.
Two bills coming that are going to address transportation costs. So we have two bills coming up. I don't know if they're, I think they're next week, that will address transportation costs. So we are very aware of all of the variety of needs, so we are going to be looking at that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's go on to Representative Johnson, House File 1944. This one should be fairly quick, and then we will spend whatever time that remains with Representative Vandeveer's bill. And this was some kind of a new issue for me, Representative Johnson, the pool ventilation issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While my testifiers are coming forward here today, I'll have to admit that this was a new idea to me, too.
You may move your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1944 for possible consideration and inclusion in the House Education Finance Omnibus Bill. Madam Chair, in St. Peter, we have a championship girls swimming team, but we have a pool that is having an adverse effect on the health of that champion team, and so I've invited some people to explain the problem and the solution. I'll ask each of them to identify themselves for the record and present either their testimony or be available for questions.
All right. Which of you is going to present the issue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Olson. I'm the superintendent of the St. Peter Public Schools. You have a handout in front of you, I believe, that we can move through very quickly. Basically, what we have is a situation where we had a pool that was built in 1980. When that pool was built in 1980, the pool was designed so that air moved at the ceiling level rather than above the water level. For about 15 years, we didn't have much of a problem until we started our girls' swim team, and that swim team became very successful and very popular to the point where we have about 50 girls participating on that swim team and working out in the pool on a daily basis. The result of that is that chloramine gas gets increased in the pool because of the activity. That gas is trapped, in effect, right above the water level, and the air doesn't move out of that right above water level very quickly. The solution to our problem is to increase the airflow at the right above water level. In order to do that, we need to do a remodeling of the airflow system. Part of that remodeling involves a heat exchange or an air-to-air exchange system that is not allowed for currently under health and safety levy funding. We have girls that are experiencing some health problems with asthma-related conditions. I've had conversations with girls on the swim team where they're actually hoarse, trying to talk and explain why they think a solution needs to come about. We have skin rash problems primarily with our swimmers, but also with some students involved in the general education, physical education program. So I'll stop there and turn it over to the chairperson of our Board of Education, Dr. Terry Moore.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terrence Moore. I'm the school board chair in St. Peter. And very quickly, we seek authority to levy for the under health and safety funding for the full $200,000 or so that it'll cost to do this job. Current statute wouldn't allow us to levy for $50,000 of that. That's the air-to-air exchanger. That's because air-to-air exchangers are typically used for energy conservation purposes, and I think it was the legislative intent to not let people use health and safety money to engage in energy conservation. In our case, it will not be an energy conservation move. In fact, our energy bills will go up when we finish this project. So we come before you today to request your help to allow us to go for health and safety levy funding for the entire $200,000 amount or so. This bill will have no effect at all upon the state budget. This will be completely covered by local property taxpayers. And with that, we would be happy to take any questions or clarify any matters.
Are there any questions? We have a couple of members who had to go to other committees, but out of your capital and maintenance budget, is it possible to make these repairs out of that budget?
As I'm sure you have heard numerous times from school districts, funding is very tight. We're making a $335,000 budget reduction out of our general operating fund. A part of that reduction is shifting general expenses where applicable to our capital fund. Our capital fund is also being quickly depleted. So we are in a situation where if we were to use our capital fund, we would not be allowed to shift some of our general operating expenses in that level.
Madam Chair, if I could speak specifically to that from a board point of view, I think that would result in eliminating another teaching position. Next year, because we're already doing shifts and deferred maintenance as our building and grounds manager here would tell us.
And sir, when you said your last name, I didn't catch it.
Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W.
Oh, good thing I didn't try to call you by your name a minute ago. I thought it was more like Mom or something like that. All right, Representative Cleansing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom. Is the health and safety levy equalized?
Madam Chair and members, health and safety is equalized, but it's equalized at a level of about $2,900 per pupil of tax capacity. There are only, we just happen to be looking this up, and there are only about 26 school districts that have less than $2,900 per pupil of tax capacity. St. Peter's over 4,000, so they wouldn't qualify for any aid under the health and safety program.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. Mr. Superintendent is correct. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Jeff Olson.
Olson? Okay. Thank you. I didn't follow what you said. Are you taking general fund monies and transferring into capital? Did I hear you say that? Your capital operating account to take care of maintenance?
Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, what we're doing is taking expenses that we would have paid for in our capital fund, in our general fund, and shifting those to capital, therefore depleting our available capital resources. And those would be resources that we might be able to use for projects such as this.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative
Demmer. Thank you. The reason for my question, I was a little confused. Your board chair, Mr. Morrow, said that taking these funds out of capital would cost you a teacher, and you don't pay for teachers out of the capital account. So I was a little confused by that comment.
Madam Chair, I apologize for the confusion. The way I'm looking at it in my head is I know we're putting off a series of projects that Mr. Applin, our buildings and ground supervisor, would have us do next year. We're voting on this in 2 weeks. And Superintendent Olson has put together a proposed list of cuts that equal $335,000. If we have to take this $50,000 also out of our general budget or shift it from general to capital, we're another $50,000 short. That's approximately the cost of a teacher plus benefits in St. Peter.
One other question, Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does St. Peter currently have a levy override of any kind? Levy override?
No, we have a general operating excess levy or operating levy of $385 per pupil unit.
Okay.
Can I ask you when you put that on? When that started?
Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative, the $300 of the $385 went on in 2002, I believe. And the $85 of that operating levy expires in 2007.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions? Hearing none, we will hold on to this. It will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And I apologize that you had to wait so long. I'm sure it was fascinating, though, wasn't it? Representative Vanderveer, is he here? And members, this is a somewhat different concept than any education bill that has ever passed out of this committee, and I thought it might be interesting to hear it. Representative Vandeveer, I will move House File 1563 before the committee, and that it be laid over for possible inclusion. Explain your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you also, I have the A2 amendment.
Yes, I have it. I'm sorry. It was stuck to the other piece. I didn't even see it. All right. Would you, we will move, I will move House, pardon me, I will move Amendment A2 to put this bill in the form that the author wishes it to be. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Vandeveer, would you go ahead and explain your bill and your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What the amendment does is puts my intent into the legislation that the levy work in a way that's very similar to the governor's proposal, the discretionary levy in the bill, and it also changes the requirement that 90% of the money go into classrooms to 70%. And that's what the amendment did to the bill. The purpose of the bill is quite simple. It is to take the amount of money, it takes the amount of money that the governor spent in his original proposal, 1563 does, and simply divides it up a different way. And you should also have in your packets three other runs that show different scenarios when you apply the K-12 money to the total money spent in the state, divided by the number of kids, and that's how much money you get. And the reason I thought it was important this year to do that is because with 3 years without any increase in funding, this plan seems to get the most money per student to the classroom. And what the legislation does is use the same weighting system that's currently in place to count students. So if you look at the different runs, I did include one. If you use this method on the Meslow bill of dividing the money up, it shows dramatic increases across the state. If you use the governor's money, there's a run that shows how that would work. And there's one that shows the 620, which is what this would generate per pupil across the state. And it's for, hopefully for discussion purposes, Madam Chair, I know that you've talked and worked very hard for equity in this area, and I think what this demonstrates to all of us is what an equitable application, or a more equitable application of the funds across the state of Minnesota could mean to our school districts.
Somebody just sent me a note and said, I hate runs.
Well, Madam Chair, they are extremely helpful, I think, when you use them properly.
Madam Chair.
Okay, which one actually applies to your bill, Representative Vandeveer? You said one applies to Maslow's bill, one applies to the governor's bill. Which one applies to your bill?
It would be the one with 620, 204.20, and I'm looking for the February 27th run, I think.
This was the three?
Is the one.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, it would be the February 27th.
Before we go to the
February 10th, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, can we address the amendment before we go to the runs?
Sure.
I have a question.
In fact, I think he should explain the entire thing.
Well, can we take the amendment first?
Sure.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Vandeveer, I'm looking at the amendment itself. It seems like you're moving away from the general, what we had in 01 used to be a general levy. And I think that the intent on your first was to go to the general levy, and now you're going back to the governor's discretionary levy. Wouldn't it be more advantageous, money-wise, to stay with the general then go at the governor's discretionary?
Madam Chair,
Representative Vandeveer.
It was my original intent, and I didn't communicate it properly when the bill was drafted, to model the levy after the governor's, because, and I wasn't aware that there was any advantage to doing it one way or another. It's, do you feel that there was?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hyde.
Can I ask Tim Strom a question?
Mr. Strom.
Okay.
Pardon me. Go ahead, ask the question first.
Which one would create more money? I'm looking at the amendment here, doing the governor's discretionary levy of 2.7 or doing a general levy of 2.7?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Hiker, they're both the same in terms of the dollars raised, and they're both on the same tax base, which is adjusted net tax capacity. The issue, as I understand it, is whether or not it's perceived as a state-mandated levy or whether it's a discretionary levy at the option of the local school board. Yeah,
that explains it. Thank you.
That would explain it, wouldn't it, Representative Hiker?
It does.
And, you know, on the second thing it does is the amendment. All right, we finished with that, Representative.
Go ahead, Representative Vandeveer. Did you have another question, Representative? Okay. Go ahead, Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's essentially, if we look at the February 10th run, you can find your school districts on there quite...
One second.
Hopefully. And see the comparison, because it compares it over the governor's. And primarily what we've done is we have not included any of the categories that are in the current funding formula. We've simply taken the AMCPU of the state, divided it into the dollars available, and applied that across the state per student.
Representative Vandeveer, I think we need to clarify also, there is no linkage in any way here. So there is no new compensatory sparsity, transportation sparsity, any of those things that are normally linked, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, okay. That is correct.
And so also anything in the governor's bill, like the high school initiative or the QComp or the technology, all of that would just be rolled in the formula, correct?
That is correct. Although I would point out that, this run that comes up with the 620 does not include any of the governor's new $108 million that he brought forth. So the committee could still look at those options with that money. Or there is another run that shows what would happen if instead of spending the new money elsewhere, you actually bought out the... first year levy. That run is also included, and I don't think I mentioned that. But
Representative Heidgerken, did you have an? I'm sorry. Were you finished, Representative?
Well, and there was one more run if we had spent the 108. So either you could take the levy out, or you could put the 108 on top of here, and that gets you to about 750. About $150 million less in spending, however, than. Representative Meslow's bill. Thank you.
All right, we're buried in paper. Representative Heidgerken, I have you on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Vandeveer did answer my question in regards to the governor's supplemental budgets, including later on, so thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? I mean, this is very interesting because it delinks everything, so it would certainly set a new precedent for delinking.
Madam Chair, it does, but it only does it on the new money. And so we're working on the formula and doing all those changes that everybody seems to think we'd need to do, at least for this time and this place and under these circumstances, I think we'd be getting the most money out to our schools as possible.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. First, a clarification. Are we on the bill or the amendment?
We put the amendment into the bill, so the amendment is part of the bill. So it's whatever you wish to question.
Okay.
Question whichever you wish, Representative.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vandeveer, it seems to me that what this bill does, in essence, is lock in the cuts of 2003 and establish that as a base year, and then build from there. Is that an accurate understanding, Representative Vandeveer?
Representative Vandeveer.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, lock in the cuts? I'm not certain what you're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Representative Daphne.
2003, the governor proposed and legislature passed $185 million in cuts to the K-12 system, early childhood cuts in ELL, special education, and so on. The Minneapolis School District was hit 3.5 times deeper than the average school district in the state on a per pupil basis by those cuts. They were very targeted. It appears that what you're doing with this is you're building in an escalator, but you're using those 2003 cuts as you're incorporating those 2003 cuts as the base.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, I don't think they're related, and I don't think that's what we're doing.
Representative Demmer, to this point?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vandeveer, your bill strictly deals with the formula, if I'm understanding correctly. You're adding money to the formula. You're adding money to the formula. Is that, are we dealing with any kind of compensatory, any kind of categorical fundings in your bill?
No, Madam Chair, Representative, we are not. What we're just writing above the formula, and we are using, the only thing in the formula I think we're using is the AMCPU.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Representative Dabney, this bill deals with the formula. We didn't do anything to the formula in 2003. There were no cuts to that, so I'm not sure that, I don't understand. With Representative Vandeveer, I don't understand what you're talking about with this relating to the other areas you're talking about. This bill doesn't deal with those things.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representatives Vandeveer and Demmer. That's because I was just getting warmed up. Yeah. Like, we're back in 15 minutes, right? I can't remember the public event I was at, but the next speaker was a African-American Baptist preacher, and the last speaker had left a note on that said 2 minutes. They'd gotten the 2 minute warning, and the African American Baptist preacher got up and looked it up and said, "I can't even clear my throat in 2 minutes."
And the last couple of days, you've had a little trouble.
That's a fair point, Madam Chair.
I should suggest that we have a 20 minute warning before us, because at 5 o'clock, we are due back on the floor.
Okay.
Correct? 5 o'clock.
Yeah. I'll try not to take the whole time. I guess perhaps the way to approach the issue I'm attempting to raise here is that this bill does de-link, and in that respect, it does not, I don't think, while it's an interesting proposal, don't misunderstand, it doesn't go to the real cost drivers. If you just look at the cost of gasoline and diesel fuel, whether it's heating or for transportation, which is a categorical, and particularly in greater Minnesota, the transportation sparsity aid that we provide. Transportation costs have gone up significantly for many districts across the state, and this not recognizing that does create some struggles for those districts, as well as the other categorical aids. And I'm wondering if you could respond to that, Representative Vandeveer. And then I believe I have one other question, Madam Chair.
I could, Madam Chair, and Representative Daphne.
While
it doesn't do that, if the runs are correct, it still provides them with the most efficient, with more money overall than any other method that I've seen spending that amount of money. Now, it may not be enough, but it is the most, appears to be the most efficient delivery system for getting them the most money, because the only school districts that don't do well under this plan, or as good as they would, say, under the governor's original proposal, is if you're going through the caps. And that's the only one very few of them don't do well. Minneapolis comes out $27 the first year ahead. So even with all the categories, these schools are still coming out good. So I don't think anyone really gets hurt in this, except there may be something we'd want to do for those school districts that feel that they need to exceed the current caps.
Madam Chair, one last concern.
Representative Dabney.
Representative Vandeveer, I appreciate the amendment's impact on line 21, page 1, line 21, changing the 90% requirement to 70%. But I am concerned much of the issue around exactly what percentage is of education revenue is spent in the classroom, in quotes, is a statistical aberration in the UFAR system that defines special education costs or that allows people to define special education costs as not being spent in the classroom, although except when they're in the halls passing, they're in the classroom. And I'm just wondering how your proposal speaks to that that situation.
Well, Representative Daphne, if it would make you feel better, we could lower that to 62% right now. And I understand that's a number that deals with that issue. And I certainly wouldn't have a problem doing that if someone wanted to, just to make, for discussion purposes, I think the 62% is what I was told would prevent that from getting into special ed.
Madam Chair, I'm here.
Representative Danny.
Thank you. I can't speak to the 62%, and Representative Vandeveer, I respect that it's your bill. I guess this does, though, cycle us back to the issue of the categoricals not being covered here. If the cost of gasoline and diesel fuel for your bus fleet is going up faster than other areas, you need to take more of that money and put it into putting the buses on the roads to get the kids to school, and yet you've got a built-in, whether it's 62% or 70% or, you know, whatever, you've got a built-in requirement that's going to make that more difficult, as well as looking at issues of needs for school counselors and social workers, things of that sort.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, I would just say that I think there are a few people that I've talked to that do not believe that the current formula with all the categories and everything else is overly complicated, overly cumbersome, doesn't work, and isn't getting the job done for the state. What we are doing here is leaving that intact with majority of the money, and we're just saying that the new money isn't using it. And when this committee finally fixes the formula and comes up with the right answers, then we can run it through the formula again. But for now, with this new money this year, I think this is a good way to do it.
You know, Representative Dabney, was that your last question?
Yes, ma'am.
Because we have three people with questions, plus I have several names on the list who wanted to say something about this bill. And I guess I would ask them all to come up and then be very brief, please, wherever you are. We have Brad Lundell, who's sitting at the desk. Go ahead, Mr. Lundell. And while you're talking, Mary Ciccone, Deb Griffiths, and Stephanie Atkins.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell again from Schools for Equity and Education. I'd like to thank Representative Vandeveer. I called him Senator because I testified on the same bill in the House in the Senate this morning. But I think that what Representative Vandeveer has done is put together an interesting approach for discussion as we move forward in this legislative session. I do share the same concerns that Representative Dabney shares about the linkage, or the delinkage, if you will, in the bill. But I think, just to give you some history, I had Mr. Walsh's job in the Senate years ago, and one year when we were putting together our bill, we did basically the same thing, and as every member came with an amendment, the amendment had to change the general ed amount at the same time it spent money on something else. So we started with a high number that got progressively lower. We thought it would stop amendments, but unfortunately it did not. But I think that what Representative Vandeveer has done is shown that the general education amount is the engine that drives most school funding. And I think it's the money that gets out to the most kids in the best way. I'm not going to talk about QComp. I think QComp's a good idea. I think it's an idea that's time may have come. As you move forward, though, and you have those discussions, I think it's important to find the balance between what you're going to do in QComp and then keeping the formula in mind at the same time. I know that you're going to do that, but I think what Representative Vandeveer has done is kind of given that lighthouse, if you will, of what the formula amount would be if you used all the governor's money in the way that he has proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell, and thank you so much for being brief. That was very good.
I'm Mary Ciccone with Parents United Network. In the last 4 years, Minnesota's lost 4,000 teachers. Our class sizes are rising. 90% of our districts have local levies in place. And parents are fundraising at a rate never before seen, and our children are still in schools that are planning further cuts. We're in support of this bill as a start and a short-term solution. For the long run, we believe finishing the governor's task force is of most importance. We're particularly supportive of this bill that the dollars come without added initiatives that may cost more than the dollars provide. We actually prefer the original bill to the amendment because the All Kids Are Good Kids levy is the ultimate equalized levy. We do have a concern of putting a percentage of dollars to be used in any category, since we believe that locally elected officials are and should be held accountable to their constituents for these decisions. And we believe that it's imperative that after the flat funding of our schools, the locally elected officials should have an opportunity to use the dollars in the wisest manners they see fit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coney. And is this Deb Griffiths?
Actually, my name is Cindy Bedstead.
Oh, okay.
I was chosen to speak. I've never done anything like this before. I'm just a parent. Madam Chair, committee members, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to why I believe the governor is shortchanging my children with his education plan and why I believe House File 1563 is a better solution to our education funding crisis. My three children are currently being educated in the Centennial School District, a choice that was made carefully when my family relocated back to Minnesota from Milwaukee in 1998.
Ms. Benson, do we have actually your written testimony? Am I correct?
I don't know.
My name is Cindy Bedstead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we have actually your written testimony,
okay.
So why don't you just add whatever you would like
okay.
to say to that?
Then I would just like to, I would just like to say that I support Representative Vandiver's leadership with 1563 to put necessary dollars in my kids' classroom now. I believe the All Kids Are Good levy is an equitable, fair, and stable way to do it. I ask committee members to support 1563, to do it for Greg, Megan, and Caleb, my children, and to do it for all public school children that are constitutionally guaranteed an adequate education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is the other person whose name I mentioned here? Stephanie Atkins?
No, she had to go for her children.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry we ended up so late. Thank you for your patience. All right, then, if there are questions for, there are three. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Vandiver, I just want to also compliment you on having an interesting bill. And when we have an interesting bill, it's always a dicey thing, I think. But you've got the opposite of the formula that we have and quite opposite from the governor and what he's proposing. And, you know, I think it's a sign of the times that we just want to, you know, get rid of all these other things so we can dump as much money on the formula and the fact that there would be testifiers in favor of it. I see it as a very stopgap, short-term thing, you know, reflective of the times that we're in. And I'm glad to see that you got Representative Krinke even to sign on to this bill, you know, acknowledging that schools do need more money, and you know, reflective of maybe some of the things going on in his district with schools having to close and so forth. But I worry about this bill, quite frankly, members, in terms of long-term thinking, because I think that we have generally come to support some of the cost differentials that we have for districts around our state, and if we just for the short term, because of the dire times, ditched all those things that we've so carefully come forward with, then I worry that we would leave them behind for quite a long time and we might have trouble getting them back again. So I'd rather that we fund the formula with the cost differentials intact and maybe try to put more in there then, because obviously some districts don't get as much under, you know, when we fund those kinds of things.
I don't think, do you need to comment on that, Representative?
I don't need to, Madam Chair.
To that point, Representative?
Well, just a clarification. Representative Vandiver, is Representative Krinke currently a co-author of this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I think Representative Krinke withdrew as an author.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Heidgerken.
Just a quick question, Representative Van Veer. My assumption is that we are going to have the staff development monies that the governor's is saying there's going to be 2% set aside. Your bill, I think, makes the assumption that we're going to continue what we're doing right now, giving the school district the flexibility with those monies.
Representative Van Veer.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken. Yes, it does as it sits here. However, it doesn't take the new money that the governor has proposed. So the bill does assume, though, that we do nothing but what you said.
Okay. Actually, Representative Heidgerken, with nothing said, it reverts to the language we had until 2 years ago when it was that language was suspended for 2 years.
Madam Chair, so...
Representative.
So in other words, when I look at these runs, they're not they're, the money in the formula is up and over the staff development monies, or the staff development monies are in here.
The old staff development money.
I'm just looking at his monies now that he has.
I mean, the old requirement of the 2% staff development would still be there, but it will be with no new language, it will revert back to the way it was until 2 years ago when it was suspended for 2 years for flexibility.
So we're going to need new language to do what Representative Van Veer wants to do here.
Well, Representative Van Veer doesn't address it in his bill whatsoever.
No, if we want these runs, we need the new language.
If we want to go with Representative Van Veer's plan,
yeah,
we would need new language right. for that, and I suspect there would be 20 other people who would want new language for something or another, too. So we will have lots of new language. Representative Klinzing, and this will be our last question. All right, are there any other... is there anybody else who wants to comment on this bill? Otherwise, we've actually finished with 5 minutes to run to the floor, and we've got the minutes. Representative Johnson, whoops. Representative Johnson, have you looked at the minutes?
Madam Chair, I absolutely have studied the minutes of April 5th, and I move their approval.
Thank you, Representative
Johnson.
And
I'm done, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Van Veer. We're laying the bill over, Representative Van Veer, for possible consideration. I'm sorry, I forgot to lay it over, but that was the original motion, so we're okay. Hearing no additions or corrections, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted, approved, I should say, and the meeting tomorrow morning we are starting at 8:45. You get an extra half hour sleep in. We will be in room 200.
What do we tell tomorrow?
And then remember, we meet tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 also. All right? So.
8:45.
8:45.